Okay, so let's take a few minutes together. Just as we've greeted one another outwardly as friends, let us greet one another as souls. So sitting upright, with the spine straight and relaxed, relax the shoulders down, lift the heart and open the door of the heart. Door of my heart, open wide for thee, come to me. Now from the heart, lift your gaze behind closed eyes, peering through the veil of darkness there. This is the seat of enlightenment as taught from ancient times. Oh, lift up your eyes unto the hills, as it says in the Old Testament, gazing, peering through this veil, waiting calmly with an open heart. Ask in the wordless language of your heart, reveal thyself. Pour into me the grace of peace, of wisdom, compassion. Let me feel thy divine presence, which resides at the heart of every atom of creation and in my own heart. Let me feel the universal Christ intelligence, the Christ peace. Feel that light, that peace, pouring in through the spiritual eye at the point between the eyebrows, filling and rejuvenating every cell of your body with vitality, intelligence, and inner peace. So let's rest in the silence for just about a minute and feel the thrill of omnipresence within us and all around. Shanti, Shanti. Amen.
Thank you. Sunshine on the water looks so lovely. Sunshine almost always makes me high. If I had a tale that I could tell you, I'd tell a tale sure to make you smile. If I had a wish that I could wish for you, I'd make a wish for sunshine all the while. Sunshine on my shoulders makes me happy. Sunshine in my eyes can make me cry. Sunshine on the water looks so lovely. Sunshine almost always makes me high. Sunshine almost all the time makes me high. Sunshine almost
Well, you're very fortunate to have some great singers, Jenny, Peter, and the pianist. I think you were here last time I was here playing the keys. Music is such an important part of our lives. Even if you don't think you have a great voice, in the shower you have a great voice. We all have a great voice. Music is vibration, and vibration is the word, the witness, the comforter, the great Amen, or the Om. And this, we represent, Padmanai, the yoga tradition of meditation, and so listening to the inner sounds is a big part of what we aspire to do. I've always appreciated unity, even by just the name, as well as the tradition that you all represent, because our teacher, our, as we say, our guru, Paramahansa Yogananda, certainly represented that, and India itself represents that, that recognition of all traditions. How many of you either have read or even just know something about the autobiography of a yogi? Okay. Most of our friends in Unity and Church of Religious Science sell the autobiography in your bookshops. It's fairly typical. So we share. There's something we deeply share. And I think what we also share in the concept of unity is we want to see it. We want to see unity. Somebody joked the other day, said, "I'm one, you're one, we are one." So, sounds good to me. You know, we all just celebrated Easter last week, and sort of like clouds of glory trailing behind us, I'm not quite out of the Easter bov a little bit. And in my remarks last Sunday, I was inspired to reflect on how could something as bizarre as a teaching that somebody who had died was resurrected, possibly have swept the old Mediterranean Greek and Roman world. And we don't need to get into that entirely, but the thought that came to me at that time was that in the fledgling communities born of that inspiration and self-sacrifice of those early Christians, they created communities where in the brutal world of the Greek, of the Roman Empire, the brutal world, the cynical world, you know, the old religions of Greece and Rome had pretty much become decadent by the time of the life of Christ, and the people observed the rituals as we sort of see today, but not really, there was no grace or spirit there. So what touched, how could these people, these ragamuffin Christians, mostly who from the poorer classes, how could they have revolutionized the Roman Empire? By love, by charity. They had communities where men and women in those days were equal. There was equality and respect and love and kindness, service to one another, the sharing of food, the sharing of resources, basic ideals, but ideals that are all too often lacking in the various civilizations. I think of Gandhi's dry, humorous wit. One time a British reporter asked him, "What do you think of Western civilization, Mahatma Gandhi?" He was there in England. And Gandhi, with wry wit, replied, "I think it would be a good idea." I think the remark still holds in these days of turmoil today. You know, in 1894, a relatively unknown Swami, just north of Calcutta, upriver from Calcutta, was commissioned to write a very small book showing the underlying similarities between the Indian tradition of Vedanta and so on and Judeo-Christian traditions. Well, he did that, but he was also a renowned astronomer. And in the introduction to his book, he made a very controversial revelation, a course correction, a recalibration of the ancient Hindu calendar, which aligns itself with the Greek and the Mayan and the Chinese calendars, in which the ages of consciousness are spoken of in four cycles going up and down. And he made several predictions in 1894. He said that we are on the verge in the next few years of a great revolution of consciousness. He said the indicia of that will be seen fairly quickly, even though the period of time was upwards 2,000 years. But he said you will see that very soon people's lifespan will increase. The average height of human beings would increase. And most importantly of all, he said that there will soon be an understanding on this planet that matter is not the essential reality that it appears to be to our senses, that it's really energy, quantum energy, electromagnetic forces is the substance of all of these things. But he said one more thing, more important to me today in what I'd like to share. He said, during this time, during this age that is just about to take place, he said, people will acquire for themselves self-respect. Now, what do we see today? We see, in fact, in the 100 or 200 years that preceded the publication of his book, he said, according to the astronomical calendar, based on energy coming to our planet from the solar center, he said, was a period of transition. And so we saw things like the Protestant Revolution staking the claims on the door, as Martin Luther did, to stand up for one's rights. We saw the American Revolution. We saw the revolution of science and Sir Isaac Newton and Galileo, etc. But he said those were just the precursors. And what have we seen in the 20th century and now in our early beginnings of the 21st century? Things in more recent, well, equality in race, equality in gender, equality in religion. The sounding board, the theme of equality amongst all of us is really the theme of this nation. And though sometimes we take a few steps backwards, because, well, you know, we're human, we don't learn that quickly. Nonetheless, no one can deny that that's the theme and the destiny of this country. Self-respect. Now, I was listening to someone just recently. We teach meditation, of course, as by now I'm sure you know. Kevin and Jenny and Padma and I go back a few years and have done some training together in meditation, but somebody with a good sense of humor said, you know, in mindfulness meditation, you're taught two things, he said. You're taught to clear the mind of thoughts and then to go within to your center. And he says, and that's why I'm so thoughtless and self-centered. So, but that's the issue, isn't it? Because in a sense, when we look back through prior centuries, the last 2,000 years, when there was really no social mobility upwards, if you were born to be a peasant or a farmer or a blacksmith or whatever you were, you were condemned to be that and no more. You couldn't aspire to the pursuit of happiness, as we've been so blessed to have at least some experience, however checkered it might be, not available necessarily to everyone. But nonetheless, in that time, yourself had, you know, Padma tells me that Napoleon, something she read, Napoleon instituted the tradition of giving people complete first and last names. I didn't really know that. But a friend of mine, his name is Brockschmidt, he told me that, it's German, obviously, he told me that it means a fixer of broken things. And we know from the past that you were identified with your father's trade or whatever it was. Well, in this era of self-respect, it's really an age of individuality. We have this American myth that we are rugged individuals. Well, it's a myth, obviously, but it's it has a dark side, doesn't it? The dark side is what we're seeing in acts of terrorism and shooters and in freedom being taken to the extremes of license and so forth. The antidote to individuality, which is necessary for the evolution of the soul. You know, I love pets and dogs and animals and nature, and sometimes we look nostalgically at our pets or at nature and so forth in the animal kingdom, and because they're so natural and so on, that's wonderful. But basically, they don't have egos in the human sense. Their ability to evolve spiritually is rather limited. And so the ego is a necessary precondition to the awakening. First, to self-respect. But that's not enough. We also have to learn, well, you could just call it the golden rule. We have the golden rule, but too often we have the rule of gold. So we haven't quite learned that one. And another interesting thing about the golden rule is it really hasn't changed us that much. Reason and even education is not the solution to the challenges we face both within ourselves and individuals and on our planet. The solution is here in the heart. And when the heart awakens and we feel our connection with one another, regardless of skin color or our gender identification or our religion, our culture, our language, when we feel that connection, not just mentally affirm it, because when the chips are down and it's flight or fright, your beliefs won't save you. But your heart can. And so to this awakening of self-respect, the divine, if you will, has sent a message to us of oneness. It's an enlightened self-interest, isn't it? And so with our self-respect, which is necessary for us, we can't respect other people until we respect ourselves. We can't accept other people until we get in touch with our own center, calm inner center. This is the practice of meditation. It's no coincidence that millions of people meditate in the world today, that not a week goes by that there aren't clinical studies on the benefits of mindfulness and meditation on a deep soul level. people like you and I and millions of people around the world know that in the intensity and the rapid change and the overstimulation of the world that we have created by our awakening to science and technology and to the possibility of self-destruction, that we need an antidote. Our soul cries, those of sensitivity cry for something more than ego affirmation, something more than looking out for number one, something more than getting mine, and the hell with you. And that sensitive awakening, and that's partly our love of nature, the love of nature that the Northwest particularly embodies so beautifully, but the entire world, even countries that are a little bit behind the curve as we might view it, places like China and India, you know, there are all sorts of initiatives taking place for clean air, clean water, for the preservation of the species and so forth. There's a deep need for self-connection with the rest of the world. I remember when recycling hit California. I was born and raised in California. I hope you won't hold that against me. I remember telling somebody when I moved here 25 years ago that where I got my electrical bill, that I was embarrassed to say I was from California. And she was so nice. Oh, welcome to Washington. I said, oh, anyway. You know, Californians have sunny personalities. And there's no getting around it. Here in Washington, we're a little bit more reserved. But once you talk to somebody, people open up and the sun breaks, right? So, you know, we are influenced by our surroundings. But nonetheless, our love for nature. Oh, I when they started recycling, when I realized that my own parents, long gone in peace, began recycling, I knew this was going to work. And I thought to myself, in those early days, I was already meditating. I said, you know, the real religion of our country is science. Science is our religion. If science says take vitamin C because it's good for you, we take vitamin C. We don't necessarily feel anything, but we have faith. We think we're not superstitious, but we believe that nice cars and nice homes and travel and all the things will make us happy. Well, they're certainly fine. I have nothing against any of them. I have them all myself. But it doesn't satisfy the heart. That's superstition, to imagine that things will make us happy. And so we need this, we have this deep yearning for a connection and a self-respect that isn't limited to our ego. And that's the purpose of meditation. And yoga is a doorway to meditation, because we can't offer to Divine Mother, as we speak of God at Ananda. We can't offer to spirit, to our own soul, that which we don't yet possess. Imagine if you give something away that isn't yours, what sort of a gift is that? It's not a gift at all. It's called stealing. So we must become self-possessed. And the practice of the physical branch of yoga, the Hatha yoga, allows us to get in touch with the very body, which is our tabernacle. The true temple isn't a building. The true temple is this body. Jesus said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will rebuild it. His disciples, who weren't that bright, actually, if you ever read the New Testament, they're always getting it wrong. And they thought he was looking at the building, you know, the temple. And one time he said, I have meat that ye not know of. And they thought he had a sandwich in his pocket. We look back and we can laugh because we understand it, but they didn't really have a clue. They needed that Holy Spirit to come and remember all things, because they just weren't that bright. But well, in the scriptures of India and the Yoga Sutras, which sort of defines our path of meditation, Patanjali has this one sutra where he says, you know, one of the great obstacles to spiritual evolution is missing the point. So let's not miss the point. We're here to connect. Unity. Thank you.
I'm on. Okay. Do I eat it like an ice cream cone? Okay. The topic that we are speaking on this morning is we are children of the light. And I was delighted during your music this morning that the songs were all affirming that we are free, we live in freedom. I forget all the words, Jenny, but they were all affirming that we are more than we appear. And really the biggest troublemaker that we have to face is the one that we see in the mirror every morning. You know, when we define ourselves by our limitations, by our looks, by our abilities, by our disabilities, by whatever the limitation that we have, and we forget that unity, that's the affirmation of your very name here at this congregation. There's a great simple illustration from India, and it's about a lioness who's pregnant. Some of you may know this one. She's heavy with child, with baby lion, whatever, cub, I think they're called. And she's so heavy that she can't catch her prey anymore, so she's getting hungry. She's not able to be fast enough to get her food. And one day she was dreaming under a tree about sheep because she was really hungry. And when she opened her eyes, she indeed saw a flock of sheep nearby in the meadow. And so she slowly crept up and got, you know, was hiding, and then suddenly made this giant leap into the midst of the sheep, pounced, got her teeth into one of the little baby lambs, and went running off with the lamb. And the other sheep were frightened, and they had their eyes closed, and they were, you know, really scared. And when they opened their eyes, they saw the little baby lion cub in their midst, because when the mother had leapt with all that strength and urgency, her baby was born, and she didn't even know it. Those of us who've had babies know better than that. But in any case, this is how the story goes. So one of the mother sheep felt badly for this baby cub and raised it. And the sheep went along, the lion sheep, I'll call them, went along with the gang of sheep and grew up, became this giant lion sheep in their midst, but acted just like them. He made the same sounds. He had the same mannerisms. He, you know, ate grass rather than meat, you know, all the things that the sheep do. And one day, this other lion came along, and he saw this group of sheep, and he saw this big lion in their midst, and he thought, this is really strange. I'm going to go and talk to this lion and see what's going on. So he went running over there, and they see this big lion coming, and they all run. And he's chasing them, and he focuses on the lion sheep, and he chases and chases, catches up with the lion sheep, says, don't kill me, I'm just a little sheep. And he says, no, you're not, you're a lion. He says, I'm a little sheep, and he makes all the sheep noises. And the big lion takes him by the mane and takes him over to a pond nearby and pushes his face over the pond so he can see his reflection in the water. And he said, look, and now look at me. You're a lion. See, this is who you are. And the lion sheep learned who he really was. And that's our story. That's totally our story. We know we're children of the light. In our hearts, in our intuition, we know the great scriptures of East and West, the great masters of all traditions, they all say the same thing. Yogananda, our teacher, used to say that you can pinch your little finger in that little pinch. There is enough electricity to power the city of Chicago for a week. We don't even begin to tap our full potential. And yet there's a great saint, Augustine, who used to say, Lord, make me good, but not yet. You know, we just sort of define ourselves by our limitations and we forget. It's like we're asleep and we completely forget. I remember one time I was working with Swami Kriyananda, Ananda's founder and Yogananda's direct disciple. And he wrote 150 books, composed over 400 pieces of music. He was prolific. And I was helping him with all his projects. And at this point, it was with publishing. And he'd just written a book, and he gave me the manuscript to publish it. And then he started right in on the next book. And at a certain point of the publishing process, I realized I needed back cover copy. So I went to him. And I said, you know, can you write some back cover copy for your book? And he said, well, I'm really totally into the new book now. He said, can you write that? And I said, sir, I don't write. And he looked at me, turned and looked at me. He said, don't ever say that. Of course you can write. You can do anything you put your mind to. And I thought, you know, it sort of got me, it sort of shook me, because I define myself by, you know, I like to talk to people. I didn't like it when email came into the world, because I like to talk to people. My husband will be sitting next to me and email me a question. Come right here, talk to me. He likes to write, I like to talk. But the fact is, we should never affirm our limitations. We should always affirm our potential. We are connected. We are in union with all creation. We are that light.